Well, good day and welcome to this episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this episode. We've got some good stuff going on in this episode, a very special topic that's near and dear to one of our regulars here on the show. Before we get into that, though, I do want to introduce the two folks that are joining me. Of course, my co-host and partner in crime, Sam Bradley, is with us. How you doing, Sam?
I'm great. It's nice and warm out here in California. Not so much on the East Coast, probably, but I had to throw that in.
It was 70 degrees like 36 hours ago, and it's like 20 degrees outside right now. Welcome to March in Maryland. Yeah, and it's good. You know, it's all part of the changing seasons, and I like that aspect of living here, so I'm not going to trade that in. We also have our good friend Dr. Joe Holly joining us again from Paragon Medical Education Group. Hey, Joe.
Hey, guys. How are you today?
Great, great. It's good to have you, and I know we're going to be talking about something that you do a lot of education about, talking a little bit about crush injuries later on in this episode, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about that.
Me too. Sounds great.
Before we get to that, though, I do want to make sure that we are touching on some things that are timely, and one of the things we're going to try to do here on the Disaster Podcast is try to bring in some current events, some things that are going on in the news at the time we're recording these episodes. And just yesterday, there was a gas explosion and a building collapse in New York City. And I think it's appropriate, since we're going to be talking about crush injuries, to talk a little bit about incidents like that, because it was a major incident requiring significant resources on the part of the New York Fire Department. And Sam, did you get a chance to take a look at some of the coverage of that?
Honestly, not as much as I probably should have. I've been working the last few days, and I did, you know, of course, you have to be under a rock not to have known that it happened. But as far as the detail, I might have to lean on you guys a little bit more. And frankly, I'm quite curious to know what did happen.
Well, as far as I know, there was a gas leak. Someone smelled gas and reported it. And about 15 minutes later, while units were still responding to just investigate an odor of gas, an entire building, storefront and an apartment building above, basically collapsed in an explosion that blew out windows up and down the block. Pretty significant. Multiple deaths, many injuries. And then, of course, the search and rescue aspect of it kicked in, because they had to basically brick by brick start removing rubble and try to find out if there were any further survivors trapped in the rubble. And Joe, do you have any insights? I know you probably caught some of the information in news as well.
I don't know that I have any particular insights. I think that's pretty up to date. There's still several, last count I heard was 8 or 9 still unaccounted for, and most likely under that pile of rubble someplace. But, you know, I thought about that from the aspect of that kind of disaster could happen just as easily anyplace else in the country with nowhere near the depth of resources that New York City could put into something like that. And that could very easily be an incredibly overwhelming event for a smaller city or a smaller service.
Yeah, I heard one news report citing the fact, I think they were quoting the mayor of New York, that there were over 250 firefighters and other responders at the scene, actively involved in the efforts of clearing the building and putting the concurrent fires, because the two neighboring buildings actually caught fire as a result of the explosion. So they were putting fires out at the same time they're trying to clear the rubble, get any survivors out. And, you know, those resources, you're right. I mean, New York City and a few other major cities are probably the only ones that have the resources available to instantly respond to something like that as instantly as you could respond. I think other places would be hard pressed to bring in the mutual aid units that would be needed to cover that response.
Yeah. Plus take care of day-to-day business.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
So it just goes to show us that there's all kinds of aspects of different things that can overwhelm a system. And it doesn't have to be a multi-day event, although this is really, I mean, they were still, the buildings to either side were still smoldering. They were still working on completely extinguishing the fire this morning. So it was still going on day two. But it doesn't have to be, you know, an event like a major natural disaster that leaves an area devastated for a week or more. It can be a situation like this that overwhelms the resources of a community significantly. I think back to the fertilizer plant explosion last year. In, was it Oklahoma or Texas? I'm trying to remember which.
West Texas.
That's right. That's right. And how that situation overwhelmed that community for a significant portion of time. So I think it's important to kind of pay attention to these events. And so for you guys in the audience out there, one of the things is to, when something like this happens, I think it's important to go through a mental checklist of, am I prepared for this type of an event if it were to happen in my community? And how would I respond in such an event? And then if you're not prepared, find ways to get yourself better prepared. Find additional training resources, line up drills and programs to better prepare yourself and your other responders, I think is the best way to do that. And, you know, it's something you guys do very well, Joe. And I know at Paragon is bring those kinds of experiential training incidents together for people to use.
I think it's a real good time to mention in terms of...
Yeah, we do. And
you're talking more about preparedness, Jamie, but I thought also something that we've discussed on a number of shows is if you're a responder, especially if you're not, obviously mostly our audience will be responders, but don't go up there on an incident like that if you're not associated with a fire department, with a search and rescue team, with one of the teams that are out there officially, because you can get yourself in a lot of trouble that way. And referencing back to some of Joe's discussion that we saw at EMS today that we're going to talk about in crush injury, I guess that happened at the Oklahoma City bombing where a nurse was out there on her own and ended up getting killed, and nobody was really aware of who she is or where she came from. So I thought I'd throw that out there. Just think about what you're doing. Be prepared, but don't try to become a responder when you're not, especially on an incident that you're not involved with, because it can just create more problems than it can help.
Yeah, Joe?
Well, you're exactly right, Sam. You know, we certainly see that a lot. I'm sure it's happening in New York City as we speak. You know, I like to look at these things in a bit of a different way, too, and that's the tremendous amount of resources that are currently being dedicated to that rescue effort, the danger that those people are in, and the concern that I have is we put people in high-risk situations in an effort to try to save people, yet we don't always do as good a job as we should taking care of crush syndrome, which is a disease process that is likely to that will kill them after you've rescued them, as opposed to doing so while they're still in the rubble. So it's vitally important to know about it and address it early on, so that you don't, in essence, put all those resources to work to have an outcome of a dead patient.
So, Joe, why don't we segue into that and let's talk a little bit about crush injury, because you know, I know what it. I know what it is in an abstract sense, but it's not something I've ever encountered in real life in a patient. Do you want to just give us a brief overview of exactly what is the definition of a crush injury and how you would present that if you were just explaining it briefly?
Sure, I'll be happy to. And actually, Jamie, I'll bet you have run into crush syndrome. You just didn't realize it at the time. So crush syndrome basically is a system-wide event that occurs when tissue is put under severe compression for some period of time. The structures that are usually involved and the most prone to cause problems tend to be muscle tissue. In general, if you've you know, if you've had your liver crushed, you're not doing very well anyway, but you clearly could have a leg or a shoulder or something like that crushed and still be hemodynamically in pretty good shape. But essentially what happens in that disease process is that compression causes either direct rupture of the cell from simply being crushed, or because that compression is making those tissues ischemic, they're not able to be supplied adequately with blood, they shift from normal metabolism, which uses oxygen to generate energy, et cetera, to metabolism that doesn't use oxygen called anaerobic metabolism. And those cells begin to produce lots of toxins because that's a very inefficient metabolic pathway. And those cells over time may gradually, in an effort to keep themselves alive, may still die anyway, not from directly from the crush, but because they've been cut off from a fresh blood supply. So those toxins that collect in that crushed area are then dumped back into the circulation. Those toxins circulate around the body, cause lots of different problems, several of which are very likely to cause death.
So what are we really talking about? So basically the person, while they're trapped, while they're in that crushed situation, that return blood flow is really cut off. So those toxins are trapped in the extremity or the portion that is under the pressure, the weight of a collapsed building or something. As soon as that pressure is relieved and blood flow returns, it's like instantly poisoning the body.
You are exactly right. And that's the sort of irony of this disease process, is that patients may well survive for several days buried in the rubble. And then shortly after being extricated from that situation, and that's sort of my point behind that. If you don't recognize and aren't thinking about that syndrome, as you are performing the extrication process, then you've done an awful lot of work to have a patient die shortly after being extricated. And that strikes me as a significant waste of resources.
It sounds like a reperfusion type injury, almost like we'd see on a cardiac arrest, where you have the sudden...
I think you're right, Sam.
It's almost like, I think about it like a cardiac arrest, because once that circulation is returning, now you have all these products, the rhabdomyolysis and all of these things that... All of the stuff that's been, the damaged cells have been creating are now flying through the bloodstream. Would that be correct to say?
Well, you're exactly right. It is in many ways a reperfusion injury. You know, the basic things that are happening there is two or threefold. One is the potassium in the cell tends to be much higher inside the cell than outside. And of course, as those cells are ruptured or die off or become severely ischemic, they lose that potassium into the surrounding tissues. The anaerobic metabolism itself produces lactic and uric acid as a byproduct of that inefficient metabolic activity. And so that generates lots of acid in the bloodstream. And the muscle protein, myoglobin, as you mentioned earlier, is a really large protein that's almost the same size as hemoglobin. So it's quite a large molecule. And essentially, when you lift the compressive force from the extremity or whatever's been crushed, and you restore perfusion to those areas, essentially what you do is wash all of that stuff into the central circulation. So you suddenly expose the heart to a severe acid state with high levels of potassium. And in many cases, that causes an immediate lethal arrhythmia, usually V-fib or asystole, very quickly, which of course leads to almost immediate death. If you manage to survive that initial insult, the other thing that often happens is, in addition to the muscle cells themselves being crushed and broken open and disrupted in lots of different ways. Obviously, all the other tissues in that extremity have had the same effect. So, in essence, the blood vessels in that extremity have been destroyed, and you're now essentially restoring blood flow into an area where the entire vascular system is destroyed. So that blood and plasma simply leaks out into the surrounding tissues and may or may not actually bleed externally. So you, in essence, open a faucet and take what's left of the circulating blood in the patient and dump it into an extremity where there is no vasculature left. So you make the patient, you put the patient in shock, basically, by dumping that that blood volume into that area. So you have to be prepared for the shock state that's going to come along with that, as well as the issues surrounding the acidosis and the high potassium levels. And then if you survive that, the all those weird other pieces of bone and nerve and muscle and other stuff that's in the crushed extremity also flows back into the bloodstream. The body's approach to that is to basically see that as a foreign invader from the standpoint of that's not supposed to be in the vascular system. And the response is very much like you'd have with an overwhelming infection of some sort. So the body turns on its clotting mechanisms in an effort to seal off all those blood vessels that have been damaged and can very quickly consume all of the clotting factors in the body, making you bleed to death because you can no longer clot. You've consumed all those clotting factors. And the body also generates a pretty profound inflammatory response to those agents as well, which can lead to changes in the permeability of capillaries that can let fluid leak into the lungs. That's what happens, basically, that causes adult respiratory distress syndrome or shock lung, as it's been called. So that's another way you can have complications and die from this syndrome. And then if that's not enough and you have managed to have all four of those things, then you can take the myoglobin protein that's now floating around in the bloodstream, and as it gets into the kidney and is trying to be filtered out, it's such a big molecule that it gets trapped in the kidney under normal acid-base conditions, and only about 5% of the myoglobin is excreted by the kidney. So in essence, you end up with renal failure as well. So there's lots of different ways to die from the effects of CRUSH syndrome. Depending on whether or not you die in the first few minutes after being reperfused or a few weeks later from renal failure and adult respiratory distress syndrome.
Well, I'm going to put away, so I'm going to put my bicarb back in my bag. I'm going to put my calcium chloride back in my bag.
Albuterol.
And my albuterol and my, and what else do I have? Let's see, my fluids for my fluid resuscitation, because it doesn't seem like there's any way to save these people. And yet, Joe, I know there is, because we just need to deal with this in stages. Would you agree with that, or am I mistaken?
No, I think you're right on the money, Jamie. You know, those different phases can all be dealt with individually. And, you know, the most acute problem tends to be the hyperkalemia or the high potassium levels. There's lots we can do to affect potassium levels. One of the things we can do is to give the patient D50 or high concentrations of sugar and insulin. And when we do that, that works because insulin requires potassium to move the sugar inside the cell. So we give the patient insulin and sugar, and that lowers the potassium level that's circulating around in the bloodstream and takes it inside cells where it's safe, as it were. The heart is sensitized to the potassium more so when it's in a very acidic environment, and we can treat the severe acidosis in those patients by giving bicarbonate, which is a buffering agent that reverses the acidosis. So we can give bicarb in large doses and try to reverse that acid-base disorder that we have going on. The profound shock that often comes along with putting a bunch of circulating blood volume back into a destroyed extremity can be dealt with the same way we deal with any exsanguinating hemorrhage, and that is to restore the blood circulating blood volume with aggressive IV fluid management. And in some cases, even doing what we can do to stop the blood flow. Tourniquets have been talked about a lot in CREST syndrome. There's very little research about the effectiveness of tourniquets, but I certainly think I think much of that has been because of some of the myths that were held about tourniquets many years ago, irregardless of CREST syndrome. And so I think nowadays with the higher comfort level and the obvious benefit of tourniquets and exsanguinating hemorrhage, they probably have a role in CREST syndrome as well to at least slow the, all that fluid coming back into the central circulation.
Joe, one of the things that I remember from your material was actually kind of fascinating because, at least as a medic, we use albuterol mostly for respiratory distress type things. But I found out that that actually helps push the potassium back in the cell. Is that true?
Well, you're exactly right, Sam. It does have a nice side effect that it does expedite potassium back into the cell a little bit. And we certainly can use that. The nice thing about that is many of these patients also have significant inhalational injuries related to the collapse of the structure. So they've been inhaling dust and all that sort of stuff. And they may well have all that stuff going on we talked about a few minutes ago with changes in the permeability of the capillary membranes in the lung and therefore lots of fluid and inflammatory response going on in the lung. Which may cause some bronchospasm, and so the albuterol would be beneficial directly in that regard. So albuterol can work for us in a couple of different ways on this disease process.
It's not too long ago, one of the local fire departments I work with had a trench rescue, which isn't something we see every day, but this guy got buried up to just about the center of his chest, and it was really hard trying to get to him. And I know we were trying to get some pre-treatment on this guy. And he was more afraid of the IV needle than he was what might potentially happen once we get him out of there. Now they've changed that. So they're allowing IOs, because before we could only do them in the lower extremities, which isn't going to be real helpful if the guy's buried up to his waist or higher. But now we can do them in the arm, in the humerus. So that's a big help. But would it be true that 4 hours is about the outside margin that you would pretty much expect to see CREST syndrome versus, but in some cases it might be as early as an hour? Is this true?
Yeah, the time variability is, it's difficult because there's essentially an inverse relationship between the amount of pressure that's placed on the tissue and how long that pressure's been there. So this sort of harkens back a little bit to Jamie's comment earlier that we don't see that very much in sort of our day-to-day practice. But I think in reality we probably see it a lot more often than we think. I think we probably see it in the very elderly patient who goes to the restroom at 9 o'clock at night and whose hip breaks and they fall on the tile floor. And they're not found for 18 hours. Those folks can have a CREST syndrome. It tends to obviously be slower in onset. The body's got more time to compensate. The amount of CREST is less. But in general, if you look at those patients and you compare them to patients with severe CREST syndrome, you see the same things. You see the elevated potassium levels. You see mild changes in their acid-base status. You may see myoglobin in the urine. You may see all of those different things. They just occur more slowly. So, in general, the ischemic time for the tissue is usually touted to be around the 4-hour mark, like you discussed, especially in a significant CREST, where tissue perfusion has been cut off for several hours. But it's hard to sort of just put a number on it. I think you have to take the whole thing into perspective and say, you know, this guy's entire thigh has been crushed pretty severely. He easily could be having issues with crush syndrome within an hour of doing that, just like you would put a tourniquet on at the up high on the leg and have, you know, ischemic signs and symptoms below that within a few minutes of lack of blood flow there.
So by the same token, in terms, because we don't think about this in terms, you know, with medical patients so much as we do trauma and disaster, but would it be safe to say a drug OD or maybe a post-CVA patient, they could have the same type of thing occurring?
I think you're exactly right. You know, again, we're not likely to see it quite as dramatically in those cases, but certainly patients who've been, you know, in a single position, exerting pressure on certain areas of the body could easily have crush syndrome. That's not uncommon at all. And, you know, I think crush syndrome in a little bit broader perspective really isn't necessarily about having something lying on top of you. You know, we see exactly the same thing in folks who the lineman that gets electrocuted and is hanging in his harness for a couple of hours. Those guys have a very similar crush syndrome appearance and pathophysiology because they are they have large areas of ischemic tissue over some significant period of time that then is that perfusion is then restored to those areas, and they get the same side effects as other folks would get that have a large weight on them of some sort.
Well, that has to do with inhibiting the right heart return from the harness going through the groin, correct?
That's certainly part of it. You're right. I mean, in essence, you are, whether you're restricting blood flow in and out of the extremity and or back to the heart, you know, whether that's coming from a tourniquet effect of a harness or, you know, a 40-ton piece of concrete on your leg, the effect is basically the same.
Well, one thing I understood about that, which I think is a really important factor, because I didn't know this, and I didn't think a lot of my firefighters noticed it, knew this, but you can't, you know, we're kind of in the habit when somebody's syncopal, which can easily happen to these people, what do? We lay them down. And in my understanding in a case like this is that can actually be quite dangerous, that you really need to lay them down very slowly, perhaps over a period of 30 minutes or so. Can you comment on that?
Well, you certainly may need to do that as, you know, I think it's sort of situationally dependent and looking at what's been going on with the patient. You know, if most of the fluid or the circulating blood volume is sort of trapped in the lower extremities because you're hung from a harness, then, you know, you're right. You want to sort of gradually restore that circulation back into the central circulation. And by that, I essentially mean the heart, lungs, and kidneys. That's the core stuff there in the brain. So, you know, doing so slowly allows the body some time to metabolically adjust to the high levels of acid, the high levels of potassium, et cetera. And if you can slow that process, you buy yourself obviously more time for treatment.
Wow. What do you think, Jamie?
Well, I'm just, you know, I'm brought back with hearing all of these examples. And, you know, Joe, I think you're right. I have seen it before and didn't realize what I was looking at. I think that it just points out that we need to be good critical thinkers in these situations. We need to really understand what we're seeing and understand the underlying pathophysiology. And then, you know, from an EMS perspective, we need to be thinking about utilizing our additional resources. And you know, if we suspect that a crush injury situation is setting up for us, we need to talk to our medical command and get our docs online and make sure that we're squared away. And of course, in a USAR situation or something like that, you've got your docs with you. So, you know, you've got the advantage of the eyes on the ground. But sometimes when you're by yourselves or in a situation where you're talking to medical control over a radio, you need to bring up the possibility that this is what you're expecting to see as soon as this patient gets freed or brought down from the line or lifted from the bathroom floor. You need to maybe be prepared with some standing orders to move forward if you need to.
Well, I think you're exactly right, Jamie. You know, it's, I think the other thing about this disease state, and it's really a very complex disease process, but when you break it down, it's pretty straightforward stuff. The one thing that we didn't talk too much about as far as treatment is concerned is the effect that the myoglobin has once it gets in the kidney, which is basically to clog up the kidney and shut its function down. But what's really interesting is I mentioned earlier that the solubility of the myoglobin molecule is only about 5% at normal pH. But if you change the pH from 7.45 to about 7.55, which is not a huge change in the acid-base status, you increase the solubility of the myoglobin to about 85%. So in essence, those treatments that are started in the pre-hospital world are going to have a profound effect on whether or not this patient ends up on a dialysis machine, needing a kidney transplant, or any of those other kind of things that may occur later on. So it's really a big, important piece for us to take care of in the pre-hospital setting, because the ramifications of that may not show up for days to weeks later.
This is amazing information. One more question I want to throw out at you, Joe. In your presentation, you had talked about a situation where there was a field amputation of a gal who basically had a building laying on her arm. And one of the firefighters asked me a question that I wasn't sure I had the answer to. If you were to do a field amputation of the, say it would only involve one extremity, but if you were to do a field amputation of that extremity, would that eliminate the subsequent crush syndrome issue?
Well, I think the thought process is, certainly legitimate. Obviously, if you get rid of all of the toxic stuff that's in that extremity before it flows back into the central circulation, then you certainly do reduce the effect of the crush syndrome. So in cases where a field amputation is necessary, you have in essence stopped the flow into that extremity permanently. Obviously, that's a pretty extreme response to crush syndrome, and in many cases, they go on to pretty severely injured and mangled extremities that may well need amputation, but you'd certainly rather do that in a controlled environment than you would underneath a building somewhere.
Wow. Boy, you don't know what you don't know until you hear it from an expert, right, Jamie?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I know, Joe, you could talk about this and have talked about this in much more detail. And I'd like to leave them wanting a little bit more. I think that we've gotten a great overview of crush syndrome. And if you want to hear more, you need to make an effort to get to a conference and catch one of Dr. Joe Holley's excellent presentations on this and other topics to really get an opportunity to pick his brain on some of these things. Joe, thanks so much for, yet again, sharing your amazing knowledge and expertise with us here on the Disaster Podcast.
Well, my pleasure, guys. You're right. That's one of the things I feel pretty passionate about. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
And Joe, where can folks find you guys again at Paragon?
So it's paragonmedicalgroup.com, or you can certainly find us on Facebook. Just search for Paragon Medical Education Group.
Excellent. And it's ParagonMedEDU on Twitter.
That's correct.
So we'll look for you guys there. And, of course, we'll have links in the show notes for all of that over at disasterpodcast.com. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, I'm Sam Bradley pretty much everywhere. Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter. And of course, you can find me on the disasterpodcast.com, Facebook as well. Sam Bradley, the usual places.
And of course, I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic. You can find me and all everything I do, including the Disaster Podcast and links to everything else over at the MedicCast site at MedicCast.com. And of course, don't forget to look for the Disaster Podcast in your favorite podcasting directory. So if you are using iTunes or you're using the podcast app on the iOS devices, go ahead and subscribe to the Disaster Podcast. You can search for it directly. It's available there. Also using your Android devices or whatever you'd like, but make sure you subscribe to the show so we can continue to bring these great episodes out to you. And we'll make sure we get Joe back on here in a future episode as well. So also make sure you leave comments for us over on the site. We love to hear from you. So if you have an episode you hear and you want to check in and maybe get back with Joe or have a question for us, make sure you leave those comments over there at disasterpodcast.com. That's it for me. Sam, you know, this is a perfect example when we talk about disaster medicine with looking at crush injuries and the other things that go on out there. It really is a little different.
You're absolutely right, Jamie. And I can see a lot more, many more episodes of Dr. Joe and his profound knowledge on this subject. But when we're talking about disaster medicine, it is a whole different world, although we're seeing that disaster medicine and home medicine really are quite similar. But the reality is disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.